This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. There have been many stories in the media about the rising cost of college tuition and about how graduates and their parents are saddled with enormous debt that will take much of the student's lifetime to pay off. But there is some good news on that front, and we're going to hear about it this hour. According to the College Board, this year marked the smallest tuition increase in 30 years among four-year public colleges nationwide. Now, an increase is still an increase, and this doesn't mean college is suddenly more affordable, but a slowdown in the rising cost of tuition is good news for students and parents struggling to keep up with rising costs. We have even better news in just a few minutes. But first, WFAE reporter Tasneem Shama has a roundup of some of the bigger national and local trends in the cost of a college education.
For the 2013 to 2014 school year, the average cost of in-state tuition at four-year public colleges increased by 2.9%. In 2012, there was a 4.5% tuition hike, and the year before, it was almost double that, when average tuition increased by 8.5%. But even though tuition isn't increasing each year by as much as it used to, concerns about student debt and affordability are still very real. Census data shows wages are stagnant, with median household income at $51,000. In North Carolina, tuition at four-year public institutions has jumped dramatically. Jennifer Ma is the author of a College Board study on tuition trends.
If you look at what happened in the last 5 years, so North Carolina actually has experienced a 40% increase after adjusting for inflation.
But still, she says, North Carolina has it pretty good. At $65,000 a year, the state has the 10th cheapest average tuition and fees in the country. One reason it's so cheap in North Carolina is because tuition increases are linked to the amount of state funding public universities receive.
State appropriations are one major source of revenues for public colleges and universities. When that source of revenue goes down, universities have to come up with revenues from another source. So oftentimes they turn to tuition fees.
Nationally, state funding to public colleges has dropped by almost a third in the last 5 years. This is one reason why the president of the University of South Carolina proposed a three-year tuition freeze in exchange for more stable funding from state lawmakers. In North Carolina, even though average tuition has increased by 40% in the last 5 years, the state's General Assembly has been relatively generous. North Carolina ranks fourth in the nation for the amount of state funding it receives, $12,000 per student. Only Alaska, Wyoming, and North Dakota spend more per student at public universities.
And now we have the really good news. Some colleges are challenging the idea that the only direction for tuition to go is up. Tuition reset is a buzzword in higher education these days, and if you listen hard, you'll hear a lot of buzzing as you head down I-85. This year, Belmont Abbey College in Gaston County lowered tuition by $10,000, and Converse College in Spartanburg cut its price tag by 43%. We are now joined by the president of Converse College, Betsy Fleming. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. I'm glad to be here.
Good morning to you. Also joined by Beth Harden, who is the Vice Chancellor for Business Affairs at UNC Charlotte. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And I think we got a figure wrong in that story that we just heard from Tasneem Shama. I think she used the figure $65,000 tuition in state schools. It's $6,500. We added an extra zero to that. We're going to be joined in a moment or two by Dr. William Thierfelder, who is president of Belmont Abbey College. He went to the wrong studio this morning, which happens every once in a while. And with us from Washington is Andrew Kelly, director of the Center on Higher Education Reform at the American Enterprise Institute. Thank you for being with us as well.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's only been in recent years that I can remember people talking about this, and that we tons of news stories about how the cost of college is pretty much bankrupting people or leading them to lifelong amounts of debt. This all began happening, this precipitous rise in the cost of a college education in the 1980s. What happened? What has been driving this, Doctor?
I would say a variety of issues or challenges or opportunities. One, a diversification of opportunities for students to pursue. Two, a real interest in enhancing physical plant as expectations increased, as the expectations around America increased in terms of what they wanted from a collegiate experience.
But even as the economy shrunk during the Great Recession and everybody else cut prices to keep customers coming through the doors, college education costs rose about 25% on average. What made colleges and universities think that they could get away with that kind of activity? I'm not sure to ask that question enough. Dr. Thierfelder, you've joined us now from Belmont Abbey College. Take a shot at that.
Well, the first thing I'd say is the model of higher education, I think, is the real issue to begin with. And what that means is that coming from the private sector, I've looked at higher education and I've always wondered, who created this business? It seems like a crazy business because it's a deficit-driven business.
Meaning
you start off with the assumption you will never have enough money, so you're going to have to go out and raise this money to make up for this gap, for this deficit that you have in terms of what it takes to operate the college. And then it becomes an insidious process because since you need this extra money, what are you going to do? Well, you need to hire more people to try to get more students, to try to increase your revenues, to try to go out and raise more money, to get the programs you need. I mean, it's almost like a circular.
But is that an incorrect assumption that you're never going to have enough money?
It is. I think, to be honest with you, the lowering of tuition I only see as kind of phase one. Hmm. Phase two is actually for nonprofits to develop a business model that says, we will operate on our tuition alone. That is the major problem you have, even with schools with big endowments. I mean, Harvard, who has I think right now, $32 billion endowment, they had close to a $35 million deficit last year. Well, how could that be?
Would you agree with Dr. Thierfelder or Dr. Fleming that the assumption that you will never have enough money is an incorrect assumption?
I agree with Dr. Thierfelder that the business model is flawed, mm-hmm. and that we have become very dependent upon outside resources to help sustain and support and grow the institution. So in general, for private colleges in the United States, we've created a high tuition, high discount model where we charge more, but then we also create a plan for offering scholarships to offset those increased costs. So I am in absolute agreement also that why don't we charge what it actually costs to attend?
I was going to ask you that, both of you, because you both run these private schools, and almost all schools have this thing where if you're lucky enough to get the scholarship, it will offset the cost of the college education. If you raise what you're doing is you're putting it on sale. You're artificially raising the price and then putting it on sale by offering scholarships. Why do that?
I guess two reasons. Well, maybe three reasons. It's always been done that way, you know, which is not a good answer. Uh-huh. The other is that the marketplace before the recession was a very interesting thing. People, one, want the psychological thing is I've gotten a scholarship, you know, to go to college. It's something to talk about and
right.
say, hey, look what I've gotten.
Right.
The other, I think, thing we were trying to do is I go back to this gap. How are we going to fill the gap? And so what you're incrementally doing is saying, well, we've raised tuition this much, but the discount rate didn't go up quite as much, and so you kind of got a little bit of net, you know, increase there. So you're trying to fill that gap, but that doesn't work. I mean, at some point, the whole house of cards collapses.
So, Beth Hardin, your situation is a little different because you're with a state school, a publicly funded school, but some of the reason for a rise in tuition at the public-funded schools has been a cut in state funding. Did that happen here? And to what degree did that happen here?
Absolutely. Certainly, during the course of the recessionary cycle, the public institutions in North Carolina sustained significant budget cuts. On the order of $400 million in budget cuts to the University of North Carolina system. UNC Charlotte sustained a combination of permanent and one-time budget cuts that is approximately $60 million on a base of about $200 million in appropriations.
But are you in a similar situation to private schools where the real cost, the true cost, is not reflected in the tuition?
Yes and no. We produce a public good, and we're a public institution producing a public good. And the primary public good that we produce is undergraduate education.
Mm-hmm.
And so the attention is paid to what is it cost and what are the prices, and those two things are different. For undergraduate education, we are heavily supported by the state. And so while there have been tuition increases across the board and for undergraduate education, we're very focused on keeping accessibility through pricing.
You launched a football program
this
year in the face of some of these rising costs elsewhere in the college. Does the football program pay for itself?
The football program is sustained by two fees. One's a debt fee that's $120 per student, and the other's an operating.
That the student must pay. They can't opt out.
The student must pay. Okay. That's correct. The student must pay, yes. I'm sure Andrew will have a comment about that. But the student must pay that fee as well as an operating fee as well. So it's about, in the end, it'll be about $320 per student to have football. Now, the benefit of football is that when you look at what the experience of higher education is for a student and where you are positioned in that experience, and I'm not a football fan myself, that engagement and that life that that sport brings to campus, I will say, even as a non-football fan, has been remarkable for UNC Charlotte.
The Andrew that Beth Hardin referred to is Andrew Kelly, who's the director of the Center on Higher Education Reform at the American Enterprise Institute. He's joining us from a studio in Washington. The cost, Andrew, of college has been rising, even though the graduation rate hasn't been so great. You report that fewer than 60% of students who enroll in four-year colleges earn a bachelor's degree within 6 years, fewer than 60%. Is that a reflection on the students, on higher education, or on high schools that didn't properly prepare these students for a college education?
Yeah, look, it's a reflection on all parties involved here. And the problem, though, over the past, 50 years or so, we've typically thought of higher education as a place for the best students to show up and earn a degree. And the issue is that leads people to see failure in higher education as the fault of the student, which it often is, but never as the fault of the college itself. So if you ask people in a survey, whose fault is it if you fail out of high school, they almost always blame the high school. Mm-hmm. If you ask them the same question about college, they almost always blame the student. And in this day and age, when students are taking on a much, much larger investment than they were even 10 or 15 years ago, we have to ask harder questions about the return on our investment.
Well, it also seems, no matter what the cost of a college education is, whether you cut it by 43% or $10,000 in Belmont Abbey's case, you're still paying a decent amount of money to go to college. Even if you go to a state school, you're still paying money to go to college. And if you're spending the first 2 years taking remedial reading and remedial math courses, you are throwing good money after bad, aren't you?
Well, we've got to be clear about the cuts in prices here too, and I'm sure the college presidents can speak to this
but if you look at
the actual cut here, so the sticker price at Belmont Abbey was about $40,000 in 2011-2012, but the average student was actually only paying $22,000 of that. At Converse, you have a similar distinction between the sticker and the net price. And so what you're seeing is actually they're pricing the product more along the lines of what people are actually paying as it is. So like you said, it's sort of a function of artificially raising the price and then giving discounts.
The former Secretary of Education, William Bennett, said, in pure financial terms, students might be better off investing their tuition money in stocks rather than 4 years with one of our nation's many colleges. This is the former Secretary of Education. Is that an exaggeration in your mind?
I think that's an exaggeration. it begs a question, which is, what is the purpose of a college education? In other words, what's supposed to be happening there? Because we talk about all these other things that are building up around it, the administration, athletics, all these things. It's really about bringing together people that have wisdom, knowledge, and experience and giving it to people who are seeking it. That's at the bottom level of what we're trying to do.
I want to follow up on that comment, the purpose of a college education, in just a couple of seconds when we come back. That's Dr. William Thierfelder, who's president of Belmont Abbey College. Also with us, Dr. Betsy Fleming, president of Converse College. Both institutions have cut their tuition. Beth Hardin is with UNC Charlotte. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bragg Financial Advisors, supporting Catawba Lands Conservancy on its efforts to protect local land, natural resources, and our quality of life. Details at catawbalands.org. And North Carolina Dance Theater's Nutcracker, a Charlotte holiday tradition with over 100 performers and music by the Charlotte Symphony, now through the 22nd at Belk Theater. Tickets at ncdance.org. Well, the Children's Theater of Charlotte has steadily built a legacy of artistic successes, with which it quickened after their move from Moorhead Street, their old hometown location, to Imagineon. And for much of that time, Bruce LaRoe has been at the helm, but he's stepping down, and they're also adding a new artistic director. We're going to talk to both of them about the past, present, and future of the Children's Theater on Monday, and then we're going to meet an artist mounting a different kind of nutcracker in town. Look up. It's over your heads. It's in the air. That's Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. The House takes up a compromise budget deal. HHS Secretary Sebelius testifies before Congress on rising enrollment in health care plans. And the nation remembers the tragedy at Newtown 1 year later.
Join the Diane Rehm Show for the News Roundup this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the rising cost of college education, and we're meeting with two school presidents who have lowered the costs of their tuition at Converse College in Spartanburg, South Carolina, and Belmont Abbey College here in North Carolina. Both the presidents of those schools are here, and Beth Harden is here, Vice Chancellor of UNC Charlotte. Andrew Kelly is Director of the Center on Higher Education Reform at the American Enterprise Institute. He joins us from Washington. Just prior to the break, Andrew, Dr. Thierfeld was talking about the purpose of a college education, and the American Enterprise Institute, your organization, reports that another reason for the increase in tuitions across the country is because of an increasingly outdated vision of what college means. Explain that.
So I think what we're talking about there is a couple things. Number one is as the woman from UNC Charlotte alluded to, there's a bundled model in higher education, right? Which means that students have to pay for everything that comes with a college education. So it's the football team, it's the dorms, it's the dining halls, it's the facilities, it's everything. So for students who maybe want a stripped down version of that, they just want the content, instruction, and assessment. They can't just pay for that; they have to pay for the whole bundle.
And it's like cable. It's like buying cable.
It's like cable, exactly.
Sadly,
right?
So.
And it's also like record stores, right? And the logical analogy is to iTunes, which unbundled music and made it inexpensive to buy what you wanted.
Well, that's an interesting analogy, because you bring up record stores. There are none because of iTunes. Is something similar in the wings for colleges if they don't get on the bandwagon and offer an a la carte program?
I do think it's difficult to talk about all of higher education and college education as a unit. So, for instance, at Converse, we are all female undergraduate. We have a traditional undergraduate program, and then we have a undergraduate program for women at 24 years of age and older. They have an unbundled package where they are charged by credit hour. So there are options. There are differing modes of delivery out there. So I think that the most responsive higher education institutions are those who are saying, what does our student population, our market, if you will, want? And how can we provide these differing services, these differing opportunities for them to move them through as fast as possible, to provide enhanced value? And we think of value in a very particular way at Converse, in terms of outcomes for students, graduate placement, job placement, experiences in leadership, research, but also in reducing debt loads and increasing the value of each dollar that they invest in the college. And that's one of the reasons we made our tuition reset.
Kids used to go to college right out of high school, and you brought up these 24-year-olds. And I know that the Belmont Abbey College has an extremely successful adult education program, and I'm sure that there are students of all ages at the university here in Charlotte. What are the changing demographics of college meaning when older people are coming back to school or coming to school for the first time? How has that changed what you do and what you have to charge?
Well, it's a pretty dramatic change. Matter of fact, it's so dramatic, I don't think even people realize it. If you look at nationally what's happening, we think of college as being the traditional student, the 18 to 22-year-old. Almost 50%, it's approaching 50% of all college students are non-traditional. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a huge number. And I think if you look at the public college and universities, the number is even higher.
And do these non-traditional students want the football program and the basketball program, or are they just there to learn what they need to learn to get the job that they want to get?
It varies. Some want the more comprehensive experience, and some want a more particular experience. UNC Charlotte is a bit of an exception because we are becoming more traditional. Mm-hmm. As the university has become more established, it actually has become more traditional.
So you're becoming more like Chapel Hill.
Yes, in terms of our student demographics. Mm-hmm. But that is unusual. And we have historically served non-traditional students, and they do have, a different set of objectives. Now, in a public system, their choices are not as stark. The public system offers unbundled services. There is something called UNC Online. UNC Charlotte has had online programs for years, entire programs, for example, fire safety offered to people who never show up on campus. I was at the University of Wyoming and met probably a third of our students never showed up on campus. And so there are places where there are significant numbers of students served through unbundled services and not served on a main campus.
And how does that impact the cost to those students who never show up on campus because they're doing it via computer and long-distance learning?
It ranges. It depends on the system. It depends on the campus. In some cases, they do not pay certain fees that are based on services that are available on a particular campus. In other systems, they do. They do pay some of those.
Is the quality of the education delivered and received by those students the same?
It is, in my opinion, different, but the question is, in what ways are those differences meaningful? And I think those vary from student to student. And so for the student who is learning outside of the classroom as well as inside of the classroom, which might be a student of traditional age, but may be an older student, perhaps a veteran. We have nearly 1,000 veterans on campus at UNC Charlotte. Mm-hmm. If you're doing both of those things, then there is a place-based experience that matters. For others, they need the content knowledge that comes and just comes as well online as it does on campus.
I want to talk about tuition. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Andrew.
I just wanted to jump in there real quick. Okay. So if you look at the data on online programs in particular, which is sort of the best example of you know, an external distance education program. If you look at the data on where they're priced, it is just not true that they're any cheaper, and oftentimes they're more expensive. Folks have done surveys of institutions of higher ed, and they find that the overwhelming majority of places price their online courses and programs at the same price or higher as their in-person ones.
Should they?
Which means that, it suggests one of two things. One, either the cost savings from online education are not there, or two, that the tuition dollars that online students are paying are going to cross-subsidize the in-person students and to their benefit.
Dr. Thierfelder.
I think what's important here is when we talk about the education, I'm going to, I guess, speak for the liberal arts. You know, we hear that term and we wonder, well, what the heck is that all about? It's about learning to think logically, understanding your audience in terms of rhetoric and so forth. It's being able to articulate your ideas. That is what a liberal arts education is about. And so it's not just about the exchange of information. And sometimes I think with online learning, there's this view that we can just impart knowledge. It comes across the screen. You take it in. You take it out. You go get a job. We're talking about, again, what does it mean to be well-educated? What is that involved? And I think, really, it has to do with the formation of the whole person. So certainly we want them to be well-educated, but we also want them to be well-formed and well-prepared. And that's really what we're attempting to do.
I want to talk about – go ahead.
I was going to say I wanted to take us back to the changing demographics again.
Okay.
One, it's not just adult populations compared to the traditional. It's also the changing demographics of the traditional age population. So the growing number of Hispanic and other minority students, the growing number of first-generation college students. So you would probably be very surprised to hear that the number of first-generation college students at a private college like Converse is 37%. And that would probably be true for Belmont Abbey as well as for UNC Charlotte.
Why does that matter, that there's a growing number of first-time-in-the-family college students?
I'll give you an example from North Carolina. The aspiration, if you look at where the jobs of the future are going to be, and again, I think education is about more than jobs. Mm-hmm. That's a narrow view of what life is.
Have you spoken to the governor about that?
no, but I might hear from him. So if you look where the jobs are going to be, he'll like this part. If you look at where the jobs are going to be, there's a gap between what we need to have in terms of an educated populace and what we have in the state of North Carolina, and I'm pretty sure that's true in South Carolina as well. And so what the UNC system is doing and must be joined by those of the private institutions is we're about 27% prevalence of undergraduate education. Our target in the state at this point is 37% over a relatively brief half a generation period of time. Mm-hmm. It's going to take everybody jumping into that process, and we will have to change the cost dynamics and the price dynamics of what's going on in higher education to accomplish that in the state of North Carolina.
Well,
so it does matter. And those new students, by the way, won't be the students whose parents went to college. They'll be the students whose parents didn't go to college.
Okay. I want to talk about this cost-price thing and tuition reset, which is why we gathered all of you here in our studio, both Belmont Abbey and Converse College have announced or have already initiated cuts in tuition. When did the two of your institutions begin talking about possibly doing this? How long did it take you to pull the trigger on this, I guess is the question. I'll begin with you. Ladies first. Go ahead.
Well, at Converse, we had been – this is part of a larger strategic plan that really started in 2007 and took an accelerated turn in 2008 and 9. But we have been doing intense analysis, market research, a price sensitivity study, more deeply surveying students and their families over the past 2 years, really. So before it – a full 18 months before we actually made the decision to pull the trigger. And it involved rebuilding an operating budget around a tuition price that was in line with the actual cost, but then allowed us to better leverage endowment dollars to offer more broad and additional scholarships on top of that. And this was the one moment in our recent history, we've had 3 years of growing enrollments, that we knew we could make this move without having tuition increases and while sustaining the operations as they are. So our enrollment is 12% higher this year than last year. Our freshman class this year is 30% larger than our senior class. So we are in the midst of utilizing fully capacity, and we've even maxed out some other capacity in order to be able to do this.
Dr. Thierfeld.
Well, actually, I'm now going into my 10th year, and when I first arrived within the first year, I actually lowered the tuition for the adult degree program. Mm-hmm. So it's about $8,900 a year for a student to go, which is getting comparable almost to a state tuition level. About 5 years ago, I looked at doing it with the undergraduate, and I thought at the time, after some of the research I did, you can't do it because people were equating the size of your tuition with the value of the school. And if you lowered your tuition, it was seen as you must be terrible.
Yeah, if you pay what it's worth,
that's
right?
If it's not expensive,
it must not be good.
That's exactly right. So after the recession, though, I saw a psychological shift and real change in people that said, you know what, maybe you can still be really good, and can you find a way to do this at a lower cost? And I saw the window, and so maybe about 3 years ago now, we started looking at it, we did the research, and we've actually implemented. We've done it this year, and it's been great.
I want to get back to the whole – I kind of got lost in the weeds when you were talking, Dr. Fleming, about doing the analysis and figuring out cost-to-benefits ratios and all. I didn't know what you were talking about. You cut your tuition by 43%. Put that into a dollar figure.
Over $13,000.
Now, were you able to do this because of rising enrollment, the Walmart theory? You have more people – so therefore, you can lower the per unit cost? Or how were you able to just say, okay, well, we're going to lower our tuition?
We changed
now
how we operated. So essentially, we moved away from the high tuition, high discount model and decided to charge what it actually costs to attend on average. And to then we had the benefit of endowed scholarship funds that allowed us to continue to offer awards, but at a much lower amount that were supported by funds that we had.
And Belmont Abbey has been going through some tough years over the last 10 years that you've been there. One of the reasons you're there is because they needed to turn the place around monetarily. So how scary is this? I mean, here you are. You could ton it if you wanted to, but you've decided not to.
Well, I go back to what I said. That's why the second phase of this for me is I want to create a financial model that is actually operating on tuition alone and not looking even at endowment. I don't want to look at endowment. I don't want to look at development, because to me it is a crazy world for me to go out and raise $3 to $5 million a year that basically goes right out the window, and next year I'm going to do the same thing again just to keep everything in the status quo.
As I understand it, Andrew, there are about a dozen schools around the country, only about a dozen of all the thousands of institutions that have decided to do this. If I'm right about that, how do these two schools and what they've done compare to what the other 10 have done?
Well, it's like I said. Usually, this is mainly a question of tuition on paper versus what people actually pay. And so I applaud both of the presidents for taking a step toward reducing their sticker price of tuition. Their net price of tuition, I don't think, will change all that much, which is what students actually pay after you factor in grant aid and aid from the state and the federal government. So it's not clear to me that the 43% figure is actually going to translate to the sticker price. To the net price. But I would just say the following, which is there's certainly going to be a reckoning here with respect to upper and middle income families being able to pay the full sticker price. And so colleges are going to have to figure out a way to balance their budgets without that willingness to pay.
Dr. Fleming.
I do think when we talk, again, this is talking about colleges in the aggregate or talking about students in the aggregate. When we talk about the average cost to attend, that's average. But for students in our population who come from solid middle-class families who don't qualify for significant need-based aid, this is providing a significant savings for them. Mm-hmm. And then if we think about college, not after 1 year, oh, you'll save maybe $1,000, but over a four-year period, $4,000 is a lot of money. And we heard from our students and their families with these annual tuition increases, which amounted to $1,000 off of $29,000, that was hard for them to come up with after always already coming up with a certain amount. So it does make a difference when you look at individual students and individual families.
Both, go ahead, Beth.
I will also say that smaller liberal arts colleges have the capacity to work with their students to ensure that they graduate in 4 years. And to the degree to which they can help students understand where they're going and what they need to do within a four-year period of time, that will save more money for the student.
Is that to say that schools like UNC Charlotte do not have that ability to work with students to make sure that they graduate in 4 years?
We also do the same thing, though our population is different and in many cases will have and does have unquestionably a longer period of time to completion. But we do the same thing. We've invested heavily in student engagement. We have invested heavily in student success designed to track. We have our highest level of retention from freshman to sophomore this year that we've had in measuring it. So we are doing the same thing, but we are a big school and it's a little bit harder to personalize it down to the end.
And, of course, graduating in 4 years is a lot cheaper than graduating in 5 or 6 years. Both of you, Dr. Thierfelder and Dr. Fleming, have said that your schools did this because it's the right thing to do. And both of you have alluded to the fact that these new tuition levels are more representative of the actual cost of the educations that you are providing. So this is, may sound like a crass, silly question, but were you being greedy before you made this decision?
I don't think so. And the reason I say that is because, again, it goes down to part of the reason for reducing the tuition was that I saw a study done by Noel Levitz that said I think it was something like 65% of all students, prospective college students, when they saw your sticker price alone, stopped looking. I mean, they didn't look to say, hey, is there a scholarship or is there something else I can do? So basically, you've in a sense eliminated the opportunity for this kind of education to a great majority of the country. And that was part of the reduction. And I agree. The reductions we made don't drop to the bottom line, and now everybody's tuition, everybody's going to pay 33 or 44% less. What we tried to do is put it more in line. We still allow a little bit of room for actually shaping the class, where we can give scholarships for our Honors Institute or wherever it might be.
And you've said that people would say if it's not X amount of dollars, it must not be worth very much. And you have said, Dr. Fleming, that one of the reasons that we have high sticker prices is because it can lead to better U.S. News and World Report rankings. Really? Is that true?
Well, yes, it can.
Wow. All right.
Unfortunately.
So you're paying for the marketing in your tuition. We have to take a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and U.S. Airways, which begins new seasonal daily service from Charlotte to Barcelona, Brussels, Lisbon, and Manchester this spring. More information at usairways.com. And Roosters Wood-Fired Kitchen, working with local farmers, artisans, and craftsmen to present a seasonally inspired menu. Now located uptown and online at roosterskitchen.com. The House takes up a compromised budget deal. HHS Secretary Kathleen Sebelius testifies before Congress on rising enrollment and health care plans, and the nation remembers the tragedy at Newtown 1 year later. A panel of journalists joins guest host Susan Page on the Diane Rehm Show for analysis of the week's top domestic news stories in the first hour, then the international hour at 11. That all starts in just a few minutes here on WFAE. If you'd like to join our conversation about declining college prices or just the price of tuition, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks will get you to the conversation.
In 2013, WFAE brought you the news you count on more than ever, and we are committed to doing the same in 2014 with your help. That support can come in many forms, including a donation of stock or a used vehicle. To make your gift or learn more, please call us at 704-549-9000 or visit us online at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Betsy Fleming is the president of Converse College. Dr. William Thierfelder is president of Belmont Abbey College. Both of them have cut their tuitions this year. Beth Harden is vice chancellor of UNC Charlotte. And Andrew Kelly joins us from Washington, where he's director of the Center on Higher Education Reform for the American Enterprise Institute. They've done a lot of studies about this. Just as we were going back into this segment, Dr. Fleming, you were talking about your desire to have a more open conversation about how the costs of college educations are structured and how the academy, and I guess that by that you mean academia, has kind of disguised the cost of all this because they don't want people getting into their business. It sounds like the hospitals. Well, you don't know where anything costs.
I have heard of some analogies between hospitals and higher education, but I think this kind of conversation is a conversation I hope promotes more conversation because it is important for people to understand how complicated running colleges and universities are, but how we can uncomplicate it in some ways by being more transparent about.
Would you? You don't have to stop talking just because I start talking. Would you agree with that, Andrew Kelly?
Yeah, I think let me be clear about a couple things here.
Okay.
One is I want to make sure that folks don't think that I'm at all belittling these efforts by especially Dr. Fleming and Dr. Thierfelder. I think this is a step in the right direction, but I don't think it's going to solve the fundamental problem. Mm-hmm. And I think Dr. Thierfelder hit the nail on the head in saying that this is just phase one, right? Phase two is moving to a business model that is more fiscally disciplined and spends money on what is absolutely necessary to provide the best education, not the rest of the things in the bundle.
What would that
and
be?
Let's also
what would that? Give me some examples of the things that are absolutely necessary. That if you cut everything else, all the fat out, this is what would remain.
Sure. So I think it's pretty clear that it's high quality instruction from faculty. I'm not sure that we necessarily need research faculty to be doing all the teaching. I think it's also student supports. And there's been a lot of research on student advising and coaching and helping people across the finish line. And then I think obviously some modicum of credentialing and assessment. Right. So we're sure that we know that what people are learning is tracking with the real world and the demands of the job market.
You're becoming a research university at UNC Charlotte. So when you hear Andrew Kelly say that we not all research faculty need to be teaching, that would make them very happy, I'm sure. But that would raise your costs, wouldn't it?
For research faculty not to teach, it might. One can look at a model of higher education where research is a standalone function. If you look at a really large research institution, it could operate on the same model. The research function could operate on the same disciplined model that one finds in an independent research institute. Mm-hmm. So that is a different way of looking at the research enterprise. Mm-hmm. For a school like UNC Charlotte, these are best integrated functions. And so the learning that occurs by integrating students, undergraduate students, graduate students, into the research activities for a school with our research profile is more beneficial to us than looking at a disaggregated model. Mm-hmm. But I do think Andrew makes a critically important point, which is it is about discipline. It's about discipline thought. It's about discipline action. Is about having the information necessary to make decisions that meet the model that you are producing. Mm-hmm. Again, starting a new school is different than changing an old school. That's true in industry. It's true in higher education. And so the legacy costs that you have as an existing institution are ones that you have to deal with. And so the transition process in those schools is just different.
Let me try to simplify it for anybody listening to us because it is complex. And so let me just do this. You asked, what does it simply take to do this? Let me break down the academic side into three buckets for you. The first one is you have instructional cost. Then you have academic administration cost, and then you have general administration cost. Those are your three major buckets. If you said out of those three, what is it you actually do? Well, the instructional cost, which is your faculty and the actual teaching in the classroom, that's that cost. And that's really at the essence of what the whole education
is
about.
That's not going away.
That's not going away at all. But I'd also say that sometimes that's the smaller amount of money that's spent. Hmm. And part of it has to do with a number of things. I mean, one is you look at the size of administrations, I mean, including ours. We're looking, how do we reduce our administration? It's gotten too big for a lot of reasons. I can go through regulations, legal requirements by the federal government, the state, NCAA. We have our accreditation agencies. I mean, that really hamstrings you in terms of what you can do and what you can't do, and it's very expensive.
Meaning to keep your accreditation,
yes,
you have to have certain things in place.
Absolutely. And they're very expensive, okay, in terms of those requirements.
If you lose your accreditation, you don't have a school anymore.
let's put it this way: if you're not going to get any federal aid,
right,
that's
okay,
for sure. So it's all of these things that I think add to the cost and add to the size of the administration. I think that's the part that we have to try to reduce.
You've been nodding vigorously during all of this.
I absolutely agree with Bill on this issue, and I do think there is a broader conversation that is happening even at the federal government level of wanting to rate and rank all of higher education into a kind of consumer reports model, which will, if not done, one, I think it's impossible to rate and rank all of the colleges and universities today. I'm not sure it's the role of the federal government to do so. But I also know that will increase cost and maybe even decrease opportunities for students as we try to measure up according to these standards.
Now, according to a press release released by your school, Converse College, nothing will be eliminated or trimmed from the Converse educational experience in or out of the classroom to accommodate the tuition reset. So what have you done? Have you frozen salaries? Have you frozen hiring? Have you reduced whatever profit you may have had prior to this? And won't this lack of extra money limit your future options? And the same question to you in a second.
Basically, what we've done is taken out of our gross revenues the unfunded aid that we were offering students. So it is, we have shifted the model from charging a higher tuition to be able to offer larger amounts, dollar amounts of scholarships. So as Andrew has pointed out, our average cost to attend is not changing dramatically, but what it is doing is being much more transparent and clear. Now, making this move, we had to have growing enrollments to make the shift and to not have an annual tuition increase, but essentially we have changed the operating model and rebuilt it.
And you have said, Dr. Thierfelder, that despite the cut, you anticipate revenues to remain the same. Now, revenue to me is money flowing in. So if you've cut the tuition,
it's what we describe as net revenue, which means, okay, you have your revenues coming in, you have your cost, and then at the end you have your net revenue, you know, that would come from that. What we've been able to do, and again, it goes back to what I'm saying about those three buckets, the instructional is not where you want to go in and make your cuts. And I think very often it's the first place people seem to look. You know, and not that there can't be efficiencies or better productivity and so forth, but I think that's not the first place to look. The place that the most money is being spent is on the administration side. And so the question is, how do you reduce your current administration? I'm telling you, that is the answer.
Now that you've cut tuition, have you cut
that is what we're doing right now. That's exactly what we're involved in right now in our strategic planning process and our business model.
And I would say we operate by any comparative standard on a very lean administrative model, but we made our big cuts on the administrative front in 2008 and 2009 with the downturn because we did depend quite a bit on investment returns to help sustain that operating budget. So we cut about $1.8 million out of the budget with a focus on how do we do that while still improving student outcomes. So there were some very challenging choices made, but as we grew again, we could really focus the allocation, not across the board. Everyone gets a little bit, but say, wow, we're seeing growing enrollments and opportunities for students in the sciences. So as we grow, we're going to invest more in faculty there, invest more in research opportunities there. So that is something that we had been able to do.
Andrew Kelly, you wrote an article outlining some ideas on how to shift tuition costs, in which you pointed out that net prices, what students pay after grants and scholarships, has not really risen as quickly as the total cost. Colleges obviously know about these grants and scholarships, and I'm just wondering, could they be raising their tuition in part because they know there's money out there for scholarships that they can grab because it's available?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Secretary Bill Bennett earlier, and this was his formulation in the 1980s, which was essentially to say, look, we're funneling federal dollars via the loan program and the Pell Grant program to colleges, which is changing the incentives they have to keep their prices low. There's been a lot of debate as to whether that's a causal relationship in any way, but the broader point remains, which is if you're faced with a choice between raising tuition and really making some hard choices on your campus about how to cut costs, the natural response is typically to raise tuition simply because it's less controversial. You don't have to fight battles with the faculty and the administration. And up to this point, students have typically been able to pay with help from federal loans and federal grants. So I think, but what we're seeing now, it's really important to emphasize this. We saw a flood of grant money into the Pell Grant program after President Obama took office. That has now plateaued. And so what you're seeing is net prices are starting to grow even more quickly than sticker prices. So they've actually changed places. This is a real concern.
I think Dr. Thierfelder, you want to jump in there?
Well, let me tell you how this looks really different at a public institution, a public system, UNC Charlotte in particular. And that is that, you know, we have last fall 26,571 students approximately. just over 70% of those receive some form of student financial aid. 75% of that comes in the form of loans. We still have a big chunk of unmet need. It's a big chunk of unmet need among our students. And so what they represent is the fact that if that unmet need gets to be about more than $5,000 a student, they're going to have a really hard time filling that. In other words, they're not going to get that from a grant. They're not going to get it from a Pell. They're not going to get it from a loan. They have to work. And so that work distracts them from the focus of their education. It's one of the reasons why in public you'll see a much longer time to graduation. So that work distracts them from their education itself. And just do the math, to earn $5,000 to fill that gap is going to take a long time for a student who doesn't have a college degree.
Right.
So it looks really different in an institution designed to be inclusive.
I think Dr. Thierfelder alluded to this earlier in the conversation, but economist William Bowen says that college costs rise because colleges raise all the money they can get, spend all the money they raise, and have little outside pressure to stop. How does raising money and then spending it increase cost? It sounds like the costs are being covered by the money being raised.
Well, that's why I go back to this kind of vicious circle, this loop that goes on. Because if I wanted to give you the average model in the country, I describe it as the 75-25 model. That means most small, you know, liberal arts colleges, 75% of all of the money they get from tuition covers their operations. They have to go find another 25% in order to actually break even. So you're looking at that and saying, how do I get that 25%? Now, if you have $1 billion endowment, you know, logically say, well, I'm going to get some return from there. Part of the problem even with endowments is that often they're not going to completely fund whatever it is you start. So you might say, oh, I have this endowment to cover this program, but that program is going to accelerate and grow and add things to it. And now the endowment fund's maybe not keeping up with that. So now your operational costs have gone up because you have this new program that actually the endowment's no longer covering.
I'd like to add that I think an important player in this, in terms of controlling costs, in terms of having the discipline to make tough decisions, involves the board of trustees of institutions. If they set a standard of expectation in terms of how we want to operate, where our priorities are, that helps the president, the administration, faculty know where's the line in the sand and how are we going to improve what we need to do, enhance what we're trying to do, while also meeting these guidelines and expectations. We just received news of a grant, joint grant that we filed with Wofford College in Spartanburg, South Carolina, from a funding agency who said, we want something that is about consolidation, collaboration, that reduces the resources here so you can invest more in improving the student experience and access to information. And that was a great piece of parameter, set of parameters for us to make that happen.
Very quickly, a couple of things that have come in while we've been talking. Dennis, a Belmont graduate, or Belmont Abbey graduate, says, I think the lowering of published tuition rates is a long overdue step to making higher education affordable, but now that the published rate is reduced at Belmont Abbey and at Converse, is the same amount of financial aid being offered to applicants, scholarships, grants, etc.? Very quickly, quick answer.
The answer is, when we talk about financial aid, it's a discount. In other words, you are reducing the amount of money that you're actually going to end up charging. There's not, at least for us, this big pile of money over here that we're holding out on and not giving out. So it's really a matter of how do we operate the college and cover our costs. And that's how we can determine what we're able to give to a student to help them to get an education.
Suzanne emails, I moved here from Georgia where the money made from the lottery goes to funding higher education. If you graduate from a Georgia high school with an A or a B average, your tuition is free at a publicly funded college in Georgia. Please explain how the money made from the North Carolina lottery helps offset the cost of higher education in this state, and why don't we provide what Georgia provides with their lottery money, Beth Harden?
I can't really explain that.
Yeah, where does that money go?
I can't really explain that. So we'll tell her to get in touch with me. We'll find an answer.
Are you anticipating at either of your schools where you have cut tuition that you will actually end up making more money because you'll have more students coming through your doors?
Well, I do think more students typically means more money, but I don't think we'll see more money per student, and we're able to better leverage at Converse anyway. We'll still offer aid at lesser amounts, but we'll still be able to offer that.
I think we're going to see maybe the opposite.
Lower enrollment?
No, we're holding enrollment
okay.
where it is, but you're going to see net revenue increase.
What if you're wrong?
They'll come to UNC Charlotte.
Okay.
We'll join your radio program full time.
Well, there's no money here. Let me tell you that right now. Dr. Betsy Fleming, who is president of Converse College, Dr. William Thierfelder, president of Belmont Abbey, both of which have cut their tuitions, Beth Harden, vice chancellor of UNC Charlotte, and Andrew Kelly, director of the Center on Higher Education Reform at the American Enterprise Institute. Thank you all.